KALW.
If it were me, I wouldn't have gone.
Today, why the Oakland A's plan to move to Las Vegas has some skeptics.
Look, let them go wherever they want. You don't give $500 million ballparks to people who can't even play the game.
It's the next episode of Foul Ball. Then we meet Uncuffed producer Greg Eskridge the morning of his release.
I couldn't have become who I've become without all of you. Even though I'm walking out of prison free today, it's not just about me, it's about us.
And we'll hear a poem on police brutality.
So who's going to be the savior now? Can we win with angry chanting, waving signs, raised fists?
A performance from KALW's own open mic night. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. When the Oakland A's announced they'd relocate to Las Vegas, there was a strong reaction from Bay Area baseball fans. But what kind of reception can the team expect after moving? Next, we'll unpack the inside baseball in the latest episode of Foul Ball, our series looking at the A's final season in Oakland. Here's the host, Sunny Khalid.
The A's returned to Oakland last Friday following the All-Star break for a three-game set with the Los Angeles Angels, and the torrid Oakland bats picked up where they left off.
Two at bats. That's one on drive down the left field line. Going back for it as Ward looks up, and it is gone. A three-run homer for Schumann. Max Schumann, his sixth home run of the year. RBIs 21, 22, and 23, and the A's lead at 6-2.
Max Schumann. The last place A's pounded the Angels 13-3 before almost 12,000 fans, one of the largest home crowds of the year. The A's made it two in a row on Saturday, beating the Angels 8-2.
The tables have been set for Mr. Rooker. 1-1 to Rooker, and this ball has no chance. See you later, Brent Rooker, with a home run and an early lead for the Oakland A's.
Sunday, the Angels salvaged the last game of the series 8-5 before another crowd of more than 10,000 fans. But the A's made even more news off the field. Major League Baseball published its 2025 regular season schedule, but instead of noting where the A's would host a game, either OAK for Oakland or SAC for Sacramento, the league simply printed ATH for Athletics, adding to the intrigue a public meeting of the Las Vegas Stadium Authority, which is supposed to be in charge of building the proposed $1.5 billion ballpark for the A's in 2028, revealed that there is currently no deal to finance the new facility. There are growing doubts about the proposed move to Sacramento next season, and there are many longtime baseball observers who remain skeptical that the A's will eventually relocate to Las Vegas, and if they do, that they'll do any better on the field or at the gate than they are now. In the last episode, I spoke with Chris Dobbins, co-founder of Save Oakland Sports, a local group which tried to stave off the recent moves of the Raiders, Warriors, and A's. Recently, I had a conversation with Jerry Eisenberg, the sports columnist emeritus of the Newark Star-Ledger, who grew up rooting for the Giants when they played at New York's Polo Grounds and has been covering baseball for more than 60 years. He's also the author of Larry Doby in Black and White, the story of a baseball pioneer, a biography of the man who integrated the American League in 1947. Now a resident of Summerlin, Nevada, Eisenberg has lived in the Las Vegas area for more than a decade. He shared his thoughts about the A's proposed move to Sin City and the kind of reception John Fisher's franchise can expect if they get there. What is the reception to this? Because we have this announcement they're going to play in Sacramento. Some people are saying that they'll never move from Sacramento, that this is a white elephant, fittingly, that the A's are trying to foist onto Las Vegas.
Look, let them go wherever they want. Let the people where they're going grow up and learn. You don't give $500 million ballparks to people who can't even play the game. I don't see any reason anybody should build a $500 million stadium for anybody. I think they're going to find out.
People are saying that the culprit is actually baseball's revenue sharing system after 94, that John Fisher and Dave Cavill don't really have to put competitive team out on the field. They went from basically buying a team for about $300 million that's worth about $2 billion now.
It's true. But I'll just tell you, I mentioned the New York Bears. And if people don't know about it, you should educate them. This is really the greatest. They won the International League pennant one year by 25 and a half games. Lost the first three games in the Little World Series, American Association, the International League, won the next four out there in Columbus with the Gas House game. They beat them. The Yankees folded the New York Bears, sold the franchise to Springfield, Massachusetts. You know why? Because they were selling out until they began to move the players to Kansas City, their Kansas City bar. Then they were in last place. But even then, they couldn't fool a real baseball fan. Bob Porterfield was a bellwether pitcher on the last Newark Bear team before they were folded and sold. I never forgave them. They folded the team. That team was the heart and soul of Newark, just as the A's were the heart and soul at one time in their career. You know, what A's I'm talking about, the real A's. They were part of the pulse beat of Oakland. I went up there when they built that complex to do a series of stories because I was trying to get Newark to build an arena. And like many other things I try, I fail. They now have a great arena once I stopped writing about having an arena. But I'll just tell you, I feel for those fans. And if those, like everybody's excited, the Raider fans are coming to all the games here. Yeah. Well, all of them aren't. The ones who do, I could really do without. I mean, I don't need to find mass skeletons walking down the street. We know what the barbarians did to Rome. They don't need to do it to Vegas because Vegas has got a head start going down a slide anyway. That's my sermon. It's done. Get off my air.
There is an old adage, be careful of what you wish for. Do you think this may apply to John Fisher and Dave Cavill?
How could it apply to people with money like that? Then they buy something else. You know, maybe they'll have to start an All-American Lego League. Who the hell, they can do whatever they want. With that money, they can do what they want. And we can't afford. And let me tell you something about Las Vegas. And I know this will have a big repercussion if anybody's listening to your show. The state of Nevada has improved to the point, its school system, to the point where the amount of money invested in schools is either 48 or 49 in American school systems. You know, that breaks my heart. The number of people who put their kids in private school, not because they're snooty, but because they want to get a better education for their kids, is staggering. They need to look at themselves. You're not the gambling capital of the universe anymore. Atlantic City is proving that. And now Atlantic City is taking sports betting. Every little racetrack has a casino. England was always far ahead of us in gambling too. But everybody is investing in European gambling. So they don't have a monopoly. People will come out here. My argument is, well, Convention Bureau's figures show so many people come out here. But how many people come out here twice who aren't high rollers?
That was sports columnist emeritus of the Newark Star-Ledger, Jerry Eisenberg, speaking with KLW News editor Sunni Khalid. You can find the rest of Sunni's Foul Ball series at klw.org/foulball. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Today, we're happy to be breaking some good news. Earlier this week, Uncuffed producer Greg Eskridge was released from prison after over 30 years of incarceration.
So yesterday, there was this gentleman that came up to me and he had tears in his eyes. And I've never spoke to him. He said, Greg, I thought freedom was impossible until I saw you and heard your story and see you get ready to walk out of prison. And At one point, I thought freedom was impossible. Like, I really thought that this was a daunting task that I wasn't going to be able to overcome. But God showed me something different.
Greg's friends, supporters, and members of the Uncuffed team were all at the gates of San Quentin with him for his first steps of freedom.
Once I changed my heart and I changed my mind, my belief systems, and my values, I was able to change who I was. And my behavior changed. And I walked into that parole board and they seen that change. And I just want to thank everybody. Like, there are a lot of supporters out here. A lot of you all wrote support letters and flooded the parole board with just a lot of love and a lot of support for Greg Eskridge. And I couldn't have become who I've become without all of you. And so I just want to just thank you. Even though I'm walking out of prison free today, it's not just about me, it's about us. It's a we thing. It's never about I, because I can never do it by myself. So I just want to just say thank you all for all the love. Thank you.
Break a breath.
Greg has worked tirelessly with Uncuffed since its earliest days, and he's produced award-winning stories. In honor of Greg's release, we'll be re-airing one of his favorite pieces he produced for Uncuffed. It's about rebuilding family relationships. In 2019, Greg met Cleo Kloman in San Quentin and recorded his story about reconnecting with his father. Here's Cleo.
So my family life was a blessing and a curse. I had both of my parents as a blessing. My mother and my father was there. The curse was that there was addiction in my household, particularly by my father. He was an alcoholic, he was a drug user, and he was a womanizer. And that played a big toll in my household. One thing that I realized my dad loved was sports. So that was my number one priority. It's like I had to excel in sports in order to get my dad to smile. When we were outside our home, we was in the community playing sports, I seen my dad light up like the brightest star in the world. And when I watched him watch me play, I could see how proud he was. And I did everything possible to keep that proudness that he wore on his face. My dad tried his best, but he changed. He became a different person. In the home, he was a monster. Outside the home, he was my magical creature, my best friend, the person that I enjoyed being around. And it was just feeling like I was living two different lifestyles. I didn't know how to deal with what I was going through. I didn't even understand what I was going through. I knew I felt something. I felt a sense of fear. I felt a sense of nervousness, but I couldn't understand where it was coming from. I didn't understand what to do with it. I thought, you know, things that I did was gonna change the feeling, was gonna allow me to build that relationship with my father, but nothing I did inside the home worked. I started going outside my home to find things to feel good. And one thing that I started doing was smoking weed, drinking, having sex more often. And these things were allowing me to feel better about myself. But I realized now it was an escape. It was a place where I didn't have to deal with what I was dealing with at home, which was the fear and the nervousness of what my dad is gonna do next. I eventually went to the streets and got away from baseball and lost my focus on my hopes and dreams. What the streets did was, it painted a picture like it was all fine and dandy and it was gonna be much greater than baseball, but all along, the darkness overcame me. So I started committing crimes for money, I started robbing for money, and thinking money was gonna solve all my problems. But what I lacked was the education of money. So the things that I was robbing for, I was just spending it on frivolous stuff, clothes, jewelry, drugs, parties. And when that money was spent, I went right back to what I knew, how to go rob and take from others. On January 16, 1996, it was just like any other ordinary day for me. I was gonna go commit a robbery for money so I could support my habit and my greed. That was one of the choices that has changed my life forever. I made a choice to go commit a robbery, and in the process of robbing a grocery store manager, he stood up for his right to live, and he was murdered for that. I am responsible for Mr. Soho being murdered, and I received 25 years to life in prison with the possibility of parole. So 2011, right after Thanksgiving holidays, I was transferred to San Quentin. And as driving up on a bus to R&R, I was looking out the window and I seen something that just made me smile and brought this feeling to my heart, my mind, my soul. I could feel it all the way to my feet. And it was just a baseball field. And I remember walking down the stairs, walking past the tables, and just coming down smelling the grass. But when I took that first step on the grass in left field, everything went silent. All I could remember was the texture of the grass underneath my feet. It seemed like I could smell the dirt. I could smell the crowd, the snack stands. It was like a transcending feeling. And somebody hit the ball to me, and I remember the sound of the crack. It just said, crack. And I'm watching the ball fly in the air, and it's coming closer, closer. I got underneath it, perfect form, perfect technique. And I heard that ball hit the glove, and then at that moment, it was no stopping me. All I kept thinking about was that little kid running around the bases, hitting the balls in the gap, clapping hands with my teammates. And I thought about my dad, you know, how he would feel if he could just come here and watch me play again. My dad is my best friend. And I realized something. If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad. Because I am my dad. I have the same qualities as my dad. My dad is compassionate. My dad is humble. My dad is outgoing. My dad is loving. My dad is a people's person. And those are the same qualities and characteristics that I display. And I learned that from him.
That story originally aired in 2019. Greg's work with Uncuffed will continue, starting in September, when he'll be the first Uncuffed Leadership Fellow and a full-time member of our outside team. And Uncuffed is also seeking mentors and peers who can help support Greg in this transition. If you have an idea of a program Greg can join or a person he should meet as he builds his community, email us at uncuffed@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Since we've set up our downtown KALW San Francisco studio at 220 Montgomery, we've held supervisor debates, screened films and documentaries, and highlighted the work of local creatives. And on the final Friday of every month, we've been handing the microphone over to you. Our friend Gatori Mukahinda is the host of KALW's Open Mic for poets, musicians, storytellers, and anybody with something to say. Today, we'll bring you a poem that was awarded the best performance of the night from our last open mic. It's from E. Okobi. It's an original poem she read at the memorial of her brother, Chinedu Okobi, who was killed by San Mateo police in 2018. Chinedu was also a poet. Here's E with her poem, Brown Skin Baby.
Brown skin baby. So who's going to be the savior now?
Can we win with angry chanting, waving signs, raised fists? Are righteous crowds enough when we allow our minds to be occupied by entertainers who dehumanize Black and brown women who look like mothers, sisters, daughters, human? Brown skin, baby. Who's going to be the savior now that young brothers can't speak about their fear of each other? The police, just another force to be contended with in a world that hates for Black and brown men to love and support each other, be vulnerable, emotional beings together. Brown skin, baby. Who's going to be the savior now, that queer kid whose mind may be hiding genius, but instead is preoccupied by fear of discovery, so petrified that their humanity is stifled, possibly perpetuating a vicious cycle of objectification, exclusion, obstruction, isolation, self-loathing, self-destruction, and on, et cetera, et cetera. Brown skin, baby. Who's going to be the savior now that we here united and well-developed, unwrap foil and bright paper to consume slabs of cocoa adulterated and stamped with symbols maybe foreign, maybe familiar to the little brown bodies pressed into service to pick the beans that's processed into cheap chocolate melting so sweetly on our tongues? Maybe like Mammy's milk once done for Massa's son. Brown skin, baby. And who's going to be the savior now when little brown fingers pluck at toxic cast-offs, prizing value from electronic detritus we've shipped out of sight? Turns out rubbish isn't so disposable. Worlds away, single use and planned obsolescence lives on forming islands and warming oceans that flood out coastal communities built by Black and brown hands and filled with Black and brown bodies. Brown skin, baby. So who's going to be the savior now when concerns about appearances and respectability choke off honest to goddess real talk, the kind it takes to break down a system that enslaves us to hierarchies and status? Because we are the system. The system is us. Rat race, dog eat dog, zero sum gain, win or lose. Don't losers deserve dignity too? Brown. But it's all so complicated. Brown skin. It's all so loaded. Like a cop's weapon, be drawn and pointed at a brown skin. Babe. So who's going to be our savior now?
That was E. Okobi performing her poem, Brown Skin Baby. If you're interested in joining our open mics or even taking the stage, we'll be having another one tomorrow night. That's at 220 Montgomery in downtown San Francisco. Hope to see you there. Tune in Monday morning at 11. We'll meet a UC Berkeley student who's on his way to the Paris Olympics, but not on Team USA.
If I can make a semifinal and kind of represent Sudan on in a final stage in the Olympics, I think that would be like a perfect scenario for me.
The Cal student swimming for Sudan, Monday morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.